Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
I'm your host, Bill Patton. What is Infinite Tennis? It's the place for transparent leadership. Infinite Tennis, like Superman, stands for truth, justice, and the American way. Today, I'm glad to have on the show Nigel Pugh, a fellow pro I've known for quite a few years, and we're going to have a backyard conversation with Nigel, what he's up to. We're going to talk about the USTA NorCal initiative in 12 and under tennis. And I'm glad that Nigel's coming on because he's the first person I've had who's representing the USTA to come on the show. So we're going to go to a message about how your facility can save some money, a lot of money, and then we're going to come back with Nigel.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right. Okay. Hello, Nigel. Are you there?
I am, Bill. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Great.
Excellent. Hey, so tell me a little bit about what you're up to these days. Tell us first. Tell us about where you're from and how you got into coaching, and then let us know what are you currently doing.
Originally, Bill, as you know, you and I go back a few years. I'm from Australia. Grew up in Australia. Played competitively out there. My time playing was cut short through injury, went to college, started my own tennis academy out there while working corporately, brought some kids out to America, ended up getting married to a gal out here in Pleasanton, California, and started working out here in the private sector. So that's the short story. Currently I'm working for... Currently, I'm working with the City of Fremont. I run their program. We've got about 40 courts that I manage and about 14 pros out there. So that's a different gig that I'm used to, but loving it. It's been a fantastic change for me. What else am I up to? A lot of stuff with USPTA, PTR, and USTA. I did want to clarify something, Bill, from your intro. I'm not an employee of USDA. Although I do a lot of stuff with USDA, I'm not an employee of USDA.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, I appreciate that. And even volunteers can sort of, you know, represent what's happening. You know, I mean, so yeah, I mean, that is a very important clarification. So thank you for correcting me on that. All right, so tell us a little bit about your formative years as a player in Australia. Who were your influential coaches? How did your game develop?
Interesting the way it evolved. The infrastructure in Australia is a little bit different than it was when I grew up. And essentially we would go from if you got recognized as a player, you'd be invited to a zone training squad, and then if you did well there, you'd be invited to a regional, then a state squad, then a national squad, and all along that was partially, at the time, sponsored by Tennis Australia. Then we segued a little bit into the private lesson industry where, I went out of that system into the private lesson environment where I would be working with, you know, private coaches. And I had a couple of them at the time. So that's kind of how I evolved as a tennis player, not through having one particular private lesson coach, but having multiple influences throughout my playing. And I think that was probably the most beneficial for my development. But, you know, as you know, Bill, all players are different, and everyone improves differently. They work harder or less, depending on the coach. So I think the progression for me was good, but I'm not saying that would be the standard progression for everybody.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think that's part of the point, is the uniqueness with which each player develops. And sometimes you can, you know, because someone relates to a certain way that you develop, then they're inspired because it might not fit with the way other people develop. You know, I mean,
right.
It's really interesting to me. There was a great webinar that USDA National put on that was a discussion of the top 20 players in the world. And then they showed a graph that showed the different lengths of time that different people spent in the futures, in the satellites, in the challengers, you know, and some people just completely skipped over a whole level, and other people spent a lot of time in that level. And it was very interesting to see how different all 20 players took a different path to the top 20 in the world. So,
yeah.
You know, that's,
and you know what's interesting, Bill? One of the interesting things that I found is with, you know, look at our own backyard in NorCal. How many kids that are top in the 10 and 12s are actually still the top at 18s? And I think there's been one over the course of the last 15 years that actually still remained in the top two kids,
Brian
during
Walters.
That time frame. So, yeah.
Brian exactly. Walters is the one who ever was number one all the way through. And then I heard a stat, and I think, I don't know if this is true, but it sounds interesting, and I'm waiting to be proved wrong. So if anybody can disprove this, please do. But someone had said that no one who was ever the number one 12-year-old in the nation ever became a top 100 pro in the world.
No, that's interesting. So, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. What's that?
I said, isn't that fascinating?
It is. I mean, I think that, you know, what we really need to do is coach kids to be 18 and under players. I mean, they need to have a complete game. They need to know their game. They need to have shot combinations, you know, all that stuff that wins the chess match. Okay, so back to you again. What was there a coach growing up that really stuck out to you that, you know, they were most influential and they had certain principles that they helped you with?
Well, I will tell you one quick story about, you know, an Australian coach that I experienced, which, and I'll follow up, you know, being an Aussie, it's not a typical scenario, but it's definitely shaped my dedication and work ethic. I went from one squad to another. My first day of practice, it was a three-hour session, and I was completely just spent after about 15 minutes. The level of intensity of this practice was nothing I've ever seen before. So I'm doing the typical 14-and-a-half-year-old boy who thinks he can still hang with all the guys that have been doing it for 2 years. And I'm pushing myself to the limit where I'm keeled over and throwing up on the side of the court. And I know that's not a great visual for your listeners, but I'll continue.
That's all right.
So, you know, I walk over to the coach and say, you know, this is kind of way more intense than I'm used to. I need to take a break, and essentially grab me by my shirt and drag me over to the wall and run his knuckles down a cinder block wall with blood out of his fingers and says, you know, you don't know what pain is, get back on the court. So,
lovely.
That's kind of the old school approach. I'm not saying there's any wrong about that, nor am I saying that that's the right procedure, but anyway, shaped the way I started to develop in terms of, you know, putting in the effort.
Yeah, it was a different age that we grew up in. Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely things were a lot more rough and tough when it came to coaching and, you know, rub dirt on it and all that. And, you know, a part of me I still have kind of that residual toughness that was kind of drilled into me, but then I think I've tried to become more wise in terms of not putting my athletes through quite so much, because I ended up being injured myself, you know, and it was because of, hey, just rub some dirt on it. You know, we were taught to ignore pain, and I don't think that that's a wise thing for your body. So,
no, and then yeah, all the stats and literature have proven that.
Absolutely. So, okay. So now, you're with the Fremont Tennis Center, and, you know, that's a pretty big deal over there. So do you have some goals for what's going to happen over there? You said you have 14 pros?
Yeah, I started there in April of this year. The city underwent some changes. And I was fortunate to join them at the around the end of April. So, you know, it's a community facility. It's a city facility. So our goal is to provide as much opportunity for play for the community through programming and, you know, ensuring our staff are professional and all that sort of stuff. So my goal, and Bill, we didn't touch on this earlier, but one of my other things that I'm doing is I'm training for PPR. I certify pros for the 10 and under and also the 11 to 17 course the PTR offers, and I'm also a USDA national faculty trainer. So my goal coming into Fremont Tennis Center is to ensure that we have the highest caliber of pros at that facility. And you know, I think in the past city facilities haven't been known for their quality of instruction, but that's my goal, is to put Fremont on the map as far as having the quality instruction that rivals any other facility in Northern California. So
yeah, it's maybe a mixed bag. I think I agree with you that it's up to the initiative of the pro. I mean, if you're the pro who comes in and you want to build a quality thing, then you can do it. But you know, if the city's not really interested in that, then it's pretty tough to fight them all the way to building something like that. So now, is it correct that you are the 12 and under tennis chair for USC NorCal? Are you still doing that?
Yeah, well, so my involvement with USGA is obviously that I'm the chair of the ROG development committee. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, I'm on the junior team tennis committee for Northern California. I'm on the junior council Northern California committee, and I'm also on the national junior team tennis committee for USGA as well. So my involvement with USGA is quite extensive and reaches multiple different areas.
Okay, well, that's great. So what specifically with the 12 and under tennis, can you talk about successes that have happened in the program recently?
With the growth, is that what you're looking for, Bill?
Yeah, I want to hear, because, you know, part of what, you know that there's some controversy with the whole mandate and all that. And, you know, my goal is to be very even and allow for as much really good discussion on the pros and cons, the things that are great, the things that need to be improved, you know, whatever. I don't take this stuff personally, but I think it would be great for people to hear about, you know, successes that are happening with with the 12 and under tennis. So, you know, who better to speak to that?
Well, I mean, and I can speak on a couple of different areas that we've had some huge success. I will say, you know, the mandate is an ITF mandate that USTA National approved. So, you know, we're governed by, here in NorCal, we're governed by the NorCal USTA, which is, you know, that's overseen by the USTA National. And then USTA National falls under, you know, the ITF ruling and things like that. So it's a trickle effect from down from the top. It's been recognized internationally, the benefits of this methodology and this pathway. I wanted to get back to your question as far as the local area and what we've achieved and what we've had success on. The growth rate for 10 and under participation, NorCal, and I don't know where we are right now, but we were the top, and I think that was towards the beginning of the year, we were the top in the country for growth of participation. So what that tells us is that, you know, because of what we've been doing in NorCal, we're getting more rackets in kids' hands, we're touching more people with tennis, and, you know, I think that's a huge, huge part of the puzzle in terms of growing, you know, our top players. And if we think about if we want to have the next number one in the country, because, I mean, really, American tennis is not at its peak right now. I think we all understand that. But if we're going to get back to, you know, having number ones consistently in American tennis, we need to build the base to have a bigger pool to draw from so those players can get developed. So our goal is to develop that. We've done that.
That's great. You know, okay, so one thing that you mentioned there was that the ITF mandate is kind of trickling down, but I had heard that the ITF mandate really only applies to the green ball and for 10 and under, but now, I mean, it seems as though the USTA has gone beyond the ITF mandate.
Well, the mandate isn't specifically the green dot ball. What it is the actual wordage, and I've clarified this numerous times because, you know, I don't think we were all completely sure in the early days of what it actually meant. What it meant was that all 10 and under competition must use a compression ball for tournaments, for match play and tournaments. The USTA adopted that, and they're using it. They're using not only the green dot ball, but just like other countries are, like France and Belgium, they're using the red dot ball and also the orange ball. So, you know, there's multiple areas that's not specific to a color of ball. And I think, Bill, I think the bottom line is that we've got to be more cognizant of what this actually is. It, at this age group, it's a development system. It's not, we're not trying to produce a 10-year-old champion, as we spoke about, you know, those guys that never made number one when they were 12 and under. They never made number one in the 18. So the whole process needs to be more focused on the development. What's right for the kids? What's detrimental? What's good? What's, you know, how can we mold it? And I think it's a collaboration, and I've spoken to tons and tons and tons of pros around NorCal and even the nation. I get calls from Texas and the Midwest all the time. I don't think there's a set process, and I think there's going to be some flexibility in the pathway. But I do truly believe, as do a lot of other coaches, that the structure is the best way to go with the development of this age group.
Okay, that's great. Hey, you know, let's go a little deeper into this. I got to run something for Nike Tennis Camps, and then when we get back, then we'll take it a little deeper because I have some follow-up for you. Here we go.
You got it. Thanks, Will.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike Tennis Camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike Tennis Camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike Tennis Camps and take your game to the next level.
Well, I guess people can start planning ahead for 2014 on that one now. But, okay, so, Nigel, one thing you have to know about me is I've been using transition balls since 1999. You know, when they first came to the States, and I think it was on court, off court, that first brought the real first transition ball, the little champs. I got those, and I loved them, and they were great with my little kids. And anybody who couldn't really truly stroke a tennis ball using the regular ball, I would just have them use those for a short period of time until such time as they could move to the basket where we had the dead regular tennis ball. So I would transition from that, what the first incarnation of transition balls, to dead tennis balls, to now you're ready to play with a brand new tennis ball. So, you know, and I believe that, you know, probably at least 50 to 75% more kids will have a positive experience initially playing tennis, and then will want to continue if they're allowed to use transition ball. My bone of contention is that I think that the transition balls are used too long and with ages that are too old. Once a kid has mastered, you know, a certain level of technique, then from then on, it should be about taking them to the maximum level of challenge. So how do you manage that? Because I think the last thing we want is kids to get bored because you know, they're capable of hitting great shots with a regular tennis ball, but now they can't beat a kid who's a pusher because they're stuck in a green dot rally.
Yeah, it's a great point, Bill, and just like you, and you and I have sat at many USPTA conferences, you know, talking about other stuff, but just like you, you know, I really enjoy the art of teaching and how to develop and all that type of stuff. I used balls when in 1996, but they weren't the balls that you were referring to. They were flat yellow balls, and they had brand new balls from my elite squad. So, yeah, we've both been in that system for quite a while. To your point, yeah. In terms of the match play and how to develop, I don't see this in my experience with the kids that I've been working with. I don't see this as an age thing. I see it more of a developmental type structure, to the point where I'm actually using red balls with adults as well. And found huge success in that aspect, you know, with the beginning adults going from foam balls to red balls to orange balls to green balls. Coincidentally, in Belgium, in some of the clubs over there, if you go into and ask for a court, they'll give you a red ball. Once you've rallied 100 times, then you'll go to the next ball. They have things like that in some of the clubs. So, but I want to get back to your point as far as how, in terms of the match play with kids playing. So when you talk about a pusher, and, you know, there's obviously multiple different ways we can describe a pusher.
Right.
When you've got a green dot ball and you've got a kid that can bang the ball, they can move the ball around the court. A pusher, in that sense, makes that kid play another shot. Okay? They make them play more balls. From a development standpoint and a long-term strategy, that's a good thing, that kid who can rip the ball has to play more balls. And I'll give you another stat, and I know you like the stats just as much as I do, Bill. And you know this one, I'm sure. How many number ones have grown up on clay in the last 10, 12 years now? So out of the top 10 guys that were number one, 9 of them grew up on clay. And
yeah,
the reason they're able to go to number one is they have to play on clay a hell of a lot more balls than they do on a hard court. So when they get up to those higher ranks, those elite players that we're referring to, they need to be able to grind it out for 40, 50 balls consistently, corner to corner, going at 90% of, you know, of their power. So we don't have that opportunity when we're playing with a yellow ball and you've got a 10-year-old that can spank a ball and trying to cover a 78-foot court. The rally length of that is about 3, where you take it to a green dot ball, it's up in your 5. So we're already increasing the amount of repetition that a kid is having to hit, regardless of their stroke pattern.
Well, and I think you make a great point.
That answers your question, but yeah.
No, that's a great point. And, you know, I mean, I was impressed by the by the player development video that had been created, and then there was that the presentation in San Francisco, and there's been multiple ones.
Right.
And the thing that struck me was the use of shot combinations by the kids. You know, you could see, I remember one point that they played where it was two high-level juniors, and I think they were playing with they're playing green dot tennis, and each kid proceeded to use three or four different shot combinations during the match, and then the other player was able to neutralize that, and then finally the one kid, you know, was able to get in good enough position for the put away. And it's that chess-like tennis that we want to develop. So with my high school team, I mean, I had a high school team and that probably, shoot, six or eight kids were ranked in the top 100 in NorCal, so they were good players. And, you know, we got the orange balls out for about 10 minutes. And I said, hey, guys, we're going to play with these orange balls just for a little bit. We're going to play some 11-pointers and see what happens. So they did this. You know, they're looking at me funny, like, what's wrong with you? We did that for about 10 minutes, and I was like, okay, now look, what did you notice from that? And they're, you know, giving me the blank stare because they haven't been taught to be thoughtful players. So I said, well, did you notice that either a deep short or a short deep combination was deadly? And they went, oh, yeah, and the light bulb went on. And they went, yeah, okay, got it. And I said, okay, now when you go play your matches, the same effect is in play when you play with a regular tennis ball. It's just more subtle.
Right.
And so we were able to create the understanding and then bridge it to a higher level of play. But I'm not going to play with the orange balls for more than 10 minutes with those kids. So, you know.
And I think that's a good point, Bill. That's the development structure that you've gone through to have them understand the problem that happens with the younger kids that don't have the reactionary speed of those older high school players is for them to go from, and this is a generalization, but for them to go from an orange ball to a yellow ball, there's an extreme difference in speed, which takes a lot more skill to be able to formulate the same pattern of play that they would have done on the orange ball. That's the difference in that.
Well, yeah, and now here's another thing. Okay, here's a guiding principle that I have because I've used the transition ball since 99. My philosophy with that, and tell me whether you agree or differ or whatever, is that when a kid can maintain the integrity of their strokes and the thoughtfulness of their play at a certain level, then they ought to move to the next level. So then, if they're a red ball player and they have their follow through, they have a good finish on their shot, they have a solid contact point, they can move the ball around the court and hit it where they want, great, do that for a little while. But now next week you're going to be in the orange ball and now we're going to challenge you. And then you'll stay there in the orange ball level until you can maintain your stroke integrity while competing. What do you think of that as a general guideline?
Well, I think that's got some merit in it. I like the fact that you said that you got to maintain this. You know, you got to be within the stroke parameters in a match scenario. And you know, if for the parents out there, that if there's any parents that are listening to this, the reason we go through technical change. Are you there, Bill?
Yeah, I'm here. And then, have heard the 90-second warning, and that just means that the live portion of the show is going to end, but the rest is going to be recorded. So we still have plenty of time, so don't worry about that. But go on.
So, one thing that we need to try and it's difficult to go in, and I think as coaches, I've certainly done this numerous times, and it's not the right way. I've gone in with my lesson plan for a Monday afternoon private lesson and said, okay, kids, we're going to work on forehands. But realistically, if I haven't seen them play and I don't know how they play in a match scenario, then I don't really know what to work on. So what we need to do as coaches, and I think we're doing a much better job of this in NorCal, and that's been proven in our team play that we've gone through, we need to determine what are the technical deficiencies or technical areas we need to work on based on their tactical deficiencies. Now, what I mean by that is if a kid can't go cross-court on a ball, and is getting burned back down the line or burned on a cross-court angle because he can't hit a cross-court, then we need to work on that stroke production based on what we saw in the tactical deficiency. So there's lots of variables that happen in that. I think that when you referred to going to the orange and going up through those stroke parameters, my personal belief, and this is just my opinion, I go from Red Bull, and then I'll do a blending process with orange before that kid is solidified, or that player is solidified as an orange player. Because there's some transitioning, there's some learning, there's a steep learning curve to going from a smaller court to a bigger court. There's more angles to use. There's up, forward and back movement that now needs to be part of the equation. So we do that as a transition. We'll go through red, and when the kid is comfortable and his stroke parameters are looking pretty solid, we'll start to introduce the orange, but we'll start up a lesson plan with a red ball, and then we'll have some orange ball play, and then then there'll be a graduation up into the full orange play.
Yeah, and I think that that's definitely a great confidence booster for kids, but the other end of confidence boosting is increasing the speed and allowing the kids to realize that they can increase their speed because they're under maximum challenge. I mean, there's a reason why Andre Agassi can step into a batting cage and hit a 95-mile-an-hour fastball, no problem, right?
Well, his learning situation was his dad was firing balls at him. I'm not sure if that's advisable.
Right. So I'm not saying that that's right. That's not right. And Andre was certainly feeling abused by that. But, he now has extremely keen eyesight and hand-eye coordination as a part of his training. Well, now, here's how I've done that, though. With my high school kids, we've rallied
golf. Go back on one point. I want to touch on one point that you just made there a second ago in terms of the confidence of the player.
Go ahead.
What's your thought on how kids gain confidence? What are the catalysts that give them confidence?
Success. When they're
exactly.
successful. Yeah. So, but
exactly.
But
so the parameters have to be in a successful format.
Yeah. Well, but now here's. Success is a wide continuum, and let me give you an example. Okay, I got my high school kids, and I'm like, all right, kids, here's what we're going to do. Everybody be safe, but we're going to hit golf balls for a little while. Better take short backswings, and everybody look out. So here we are. We hit golf balls for about 10 minutes, and you know what? A golf ball goes a lot faster than a tennis ball.
Did you get some helmets, Bill?
Nah, it was a high school thing, so everybody's responsible to look out. That was their warning. Okay, so we're hitting golf balls for about 10 or 15 minutes. And I'll tell you what, after you hit golf balls back and forth for 10 minutes, a tennis ball seems like nothing. So, just a few minutes of that overtraining. The overtraining is a very important confidence builder, too, because now they realize they could hit a golf ball back and forth, which is white, harder to see, smaller, going faster, and hitting it in the middle of the strings. And now no one can hit a tennis ball too fast for them, right? Here's another example. Even with really small kids, I'll use the transition balls, but I'll toss them one, then I'll toss them another one, then I'll toss them another one, and they love it. And what they have to do is they then have to think fast, react quickly and smoothly, and what they find is that they're actually capable of hitting balls with a quicker return rate than they ever imagined. And it's fun, and it's a confidence booster, but it's the other end of the spectrum. I mean, if we're dumbing things down, then that's a mistake. We want kids want to be challenged. They don't want
things to be... Well, let me ask you this question on that scenario, and I've actually done that drill plenty of time. In my experience, when I've done rapid fire, the technique breaks down. So what I'm doing as a coach when I do that, and this is just my experience, maybe it's different, Bill, for you, when I've done that rapid fire type thing and they can react to the ball and all that sort of stuff, what I've found is that their balance is off, contact points not quite on center, swing paths are different because they're not able to work in the correct swing path that they've been working on previous to that. The good part about that, this is why I love doing it sometimes, is it's so much fun for the kids.
Well, I think you dwell at that point where it breaks down because, yeah, I like it until the technique breaks down. And then I'm like, okay, well, at this speed, your technique just broke down. So we're going to stay at this speed until you can maintain your stroke integrity. And then we'll go a little faster. And, yeah, you'll break down again. But ultimately, tennis is about time and lack thereof, right? Like Andy Roddick talking about coming to the net against Nadal. It's like running into headlong traffic, running into traffic coming the other way. I mean, it's a problem of time, and we have to prepare our kids to be ready to be quick, calm thinkers. You know, the ball's always traveling too slow. You know, so here's another thing I do. I have this game that we do with the ball machine, and it's called Can You Hang? And we'll get kids, and they might be 8 to 12 years old. And we set the ball machine up, and it spits them an easy ball, and then everybody gets a few easy balls. And then we slowly make the ball go farther apart, and then a little faster, and then farther apart, and then more top spin. And then the kids get to stay on the court until they've made 10 errors. They love it. They love to be the kids that survive. And they could hang with that, the speed and the spin and the distance moving. You know, so the thing that with that is if I notice that kids are feeling afraid or what have you, then I always go to them and say, hey, you can pull yourself out of this at any time. And we're never going to tease a kid because they made 10 errors faster than anybody. We want them to have that challenge. And they understand that. So,
yeah.
All right. So,
and my comment to that, Bill, and I really like where you're at with that. I think that's a great structure. I want to get back to the American system as a whole. If you look at the top players that we have in America, their stroke production is pretty solid. I mean, there's not too many guys that have, you know, major flaws in their swing paths. I think it's a fair comment, though, to say that, and I've spoken to some other people, that, you know, I think we fall short at the higher levels with the mental part of the game. And what you're going through there is more of the mental side of it, the challenging the mindset and understanding that, I mean, I've had kids that play tournament, they get blown out 6-0, 6-0 in their first match, right? And if they're going in with a mindset that this is going to be a challenging tournament, and, you know, I use myself as an example. The first match I played, I didn't get a point the entire tournament. I think that changes the mindset and makes it okay to fail a little bit in that sense because they know that the development and the success is down the road. So I love what you're doing in terms of the mindset of that aspect, and that's a key element that we sometimes miss. You know, we want to get the kids up into the high level as quick as we can. But if they're not able to hang and play a long point and think through the problem-solving scenarios they need to go through in tennis, that's a tough one. That's a tough one for those kids to survive, and that's what we find. We find the kids get to a point, and then they plateau, and then they lose interest because they can't win anymore, but they haven't gone through that problem-solving mindset stuff. I mean, how do you play when it's 15-40 set point to your opponent and you're serving? I think those types of scenarios just aren't really worth enough with our players. And again, that's just my opinion.
To underline your point, this is to piggyback on what you're saying there. I was coaching some kids who attended the so-called number one academy in California. And, you know, so I'm putting the kids through I'm just getting to know them, and I want to find out what they can do at the net. So I'm like, okay, we're going to do a little approach and volley drill. I want to see how you transition and who's going to be able to win some points at the net. Well, they're hitting all their approach shots cross-court. And, you know, the large majority of them, and I'm like, wait a second. Hey, everybody, did anybody ever teach you how to hit an approach shot? And I'm like, hey, have you ever seen a truck? And then they're looking at me like, what are you talking about? Well, you can drive a truck through the area where you can be passed if you hit that cross-court. And, again, the light bulb went on. And I'm like, wait a minute. You kids have been trained to stroke the ball mindlessly, but you don't know the very basic fundamental of coming to the net. So right. It underlines your point. I mean, we need to be teaching kids how to play tennis. You know,
right.
There's another
right.
one. Two two girls, both ranked in the top 20. I'm helping out with the one who's ranked number 20. Every time she loops a ball up to the other girl hits short, right around the service line, and you should be able to do something with that ball. So we inform the girl, hey, realize you loop one up, you get the short ball, you can do whatever you want. You can come to the net, you can hit an angle winner, you can hit a drop shot, whatever you want to do. What does she say? No, I have to be more consistent. And then she proceeds to groove the ball to this girl, and then she loses in straight sets. And it was a winnable match, without a doubt. So that's the product of the so-called number one tennis academy in California. You know, and I'm like, that's too bad that they don't really teach tennis there.
So, okay. Well, so and the philosophy you just hit, I think is spot on. We as coaches, we as professionals in the industry need to be more cognizant of teaching kids how to play, not how to hit a forehand, not how to hit a backhand, but how to actually play, both physically and mentally. And I think you nailed it there, Bill, with that example there as well.
And see, that's the value of transition balls for the vast majority of kids. But the problem is some kids aren't going to be challenged by the speed of the ball, and they need to be. I mean, I think, you know, I had a 45-minute conversation with Kirk Camperman, you know, and he admitted that they're probably the top 1% of all players really do need to be using yellow balls. He said that. And then in my mind, the top 1% that need to be using the yellow balls probably also have with them 5%, 9%, something like that, who will be very well helped by playing against those top 1%. But for a lot of kids, they're not going to be helped by that because it's overwhelming, because they don't have that talent level. You know, and those are the kids. I think it's really important to support the kids that aren't quite as gifted, because who knows, they can emerge as hard workers and come through.
So, yeah, I think, and that's a great point, Bill. And I think, you know, our goal is to build, you know, one of the goals in the country is to build the next number one, right? That's everyone's goal, have the number one in the world from their country. So to the point I said earlier, you know, we got to build the base before we get there. Now, those top percentages, 1 or 2% of those, and I don't really like the terminology, but those higher performers, if you like, they need to be also challenged. Now, how do we do that? And that's the structure that we've got to consider here is, you know, think back in the day of Sampras, Correa, Chang, you know, that whole group that came through, I guess in that group at the tail end of that, they were playing each other since they were 15. They were the best in the country when they were 15, and they played each other all the way through. The trend that we have, or let me back up, not so much the trend, but the opportunity we have for players now is that I have a 7-year-old son, and he and I do a little bit of orange ball on the driveway. I put a tape out, and he and I play for an hour and a half on the driveway. Well, literally, I can enter him into an 18-year-old open boys tournament tomorrow. I can put him in a tournament. I've got a championship tournament down in Fremont next weekend, and I've had numerous calls this week. Oh, my son plays orange ball. Can he play in the 12-and-under championship tournament? Well, you know, that's not the right level. But literally what can happen right now in American tennis is, or NorCal tennis, is that my 7-year-old son who plays orange ball can enter into a 18 and under open boys tournament. And you and I both know that's not the right place. But we've got that structure in place right now. And what we need to do, if we're going to foster these kids that are the base or the mass, and we need to foster the kids that are the top end, we need to be able to get them into a level-based playing. So by having what we've got in NorCal, and we haven't touched on it yet, Bill, and I know we want to get to it, the junior development pathway that we've got in place, it's a level-based play system. So anyone that's in that system, they can progress through the system if they choose to, as fast as they want to, and if they're winning, they'll get through there quicker. So it'll give us a level-based play. We will have My guess is we may have some 8-year-olds that are our high performers potentially playing yellow ball against 12-year-olds, and they'll hang with them. On the flip side, though, we may have some 9-year-olds that are playing Orange Bowl because they're just not quite ready to go up into Green Dot Bowl. So our whole philosophy is to make sure we have got level-based play in our red, orange, and green structure.
Okay. Yeah, no, I appreciate that. So here's an interesting thing. I put out a survey on the mandate, right? And so because part of this whole thing is winning the battle of hearts and minds, because you know, obviously there are some very elite level coaches who have said, I will never use transition balls. You know, and
right, but there's also some elite coaches like Nick Bollettieri and Rick Macy that said they're going to use it. So you got both best of both worlds on that end.
Yeah, but see, okay, now, yes, that's a counterpoint. But see, I think there's a problem if we lose a fairly significant amount of elite coaches and disenfranchise them and their players because there's no outlet for those kids to play. So here's what the results were from my survey, and I had 32 answers, which is statistically significant, and I actively looked for people who were supporters of the mandate, and here's what the results were. 18% of coaches answered, I'm completely for it, and everyone should support it, and we can fix it later, okay, speaking of the mandate, right? The 10 and under mandate is, or they said, the 10 and under mandate is great, it has little, if any, flaws, coaches who are against it don't fully understand it, or they said, it has merit, but I support it with reservations. Okay, so 18% were relatively positive to support it, right? 58% said, I like transition balls and great coaches can use them as they wish, but the mandate is too heavy-handed. Or the 10 and under tennis should be used at the discretion of the coach teaching pro. It should not be a mandate resulting in rule changes for 10 and unders, it will take 6 to 8 years to know how effective it is. 9% said, I don't use transition balls, but I'm not against their use. Great coaches don't need transition balls. 3%, and this was actually a friend, and he jokingly said, I'm afraid to answer the question due to political ramifications. But, you know, even I think he jokingly said that because there is a fringe of people who will not engage in any discussion. So if they disagree politically, they will suffer for that. So any comments on that?
Well, my first comment is, and I do appreciate you putting in the time to generate a survey to draw some additional feedback. I could tell you I could put it together a survey and get 100% of the participation to say they're 100% behind the mandate. They use transition balls with their elite coaches and their beginning coaches and get 100% on the other side. So, you know, surveys are great. I think they got to be, if we're going to do them, we're going to take notice of the surveys and the feedback. We've got to do them on a greater scale. We definitely, you know, the committee that I'm chairing, we definitely welcome any feedback and support. Other opinions, we look at that, we've discussed them at committee meetings. My thought on the whole thing is it doesn't take a great coach to develop a kid with a transition ball. You can, if you go through the right methodology and the progressions, you can develop a kid to be quite a successful young player. I think it takes a little bit more experience and a little bit more knowledge of a higher level of play to take a junior to a different level in the mindset. So that's where I think, you know, that's got to be a focus of how we develop kids and keeping them in an environment where emotionally it's a safe one, and then gradually builds into them becoming on their own to be able to problem solve throughout point scenarios. And I don't know if we really hit that element of it as coaching organizations. And, Bill, you know I train with PTR. I'm heading up to Seattle late tonight to do a 11-17 certification. And I'm working with
Karen Baylor's up there. She's at the University of Washington. You know, we got some staff up there that's doing the course that are 5-0 plus. I think I've got one 6-0 player that's doing the certification. So, you know, these types of things, if we can start encouraging the coaches to get on board with the methodology and how to play and also encourage the mental aspect of it, I think we're going to be in a long, much better way down the road here.
Okay. So, yeah, I appreciate that. So what's being done about the wide range of playability of the ball? And let me preface that by saying that there is a very wide range of playability of the ball. It's not the same minimal playability of a regular yellow ball. Is there an effort to make the ball really, truly standard?
Yeah, that's a great point, Bill. And you're totally right. There is I think, and you hit it, Champs, you know, Champs brought out the ball. And there's another ball brought out for like Joe Ginevra with the on-court, off-court. Then we got the company started manufacturing, Prince, Dunlop, Wilson, you know, they all started bringing them.
Right.
They have to go through now to become a tournament ball for USDA. They have to go through the specifications like a yellow ball does. And I can tell you what I use for teaching and what I use for match play. They're two different balls. They're made by Wilson that I use. And I'm not trying to plug, although I am with Wilson.
Yeah.
But they
good information.
They have a red, a two-tone ball, which I use for practice. Then they have a red dot ball. Same specs. It actually lasts a little longer. The kids like it a lot because it's not the two-tone ball that they think is a training tool. It actually looks like an official ball to them. And to be honest, I've found more of a true bounce, a consistent bounce when I've popped, you know, 30 to 60 cans. Every ball seems to be coming out of the cans right on par with the last one. So that's a great point. And I think for coaches out there and even parents, try and get a consistent ball that is going to be helpful.
I would advise coaches to get samples of different brands and test them before making a major purchase. Because I had two different brands of red balls that I tell you they just didn't bounce. And Tops did a red ball, and then it's supposed to make it easy. I had a five-year-old giving me the stink up. Like, hey, coach, what are you trying to do, man? You know, isn't this supposed to be easier? You know, so the other thing I found is that some orange balls don't play well at all under 60 degrees temperature, and others fly way too much when it's over 60 degrees.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. And, you know, the difference with the balls that I'm using from the training ball to the tournament ball, the training ball comes in a loose plastic bag, which obviously, you know, can be half the time they go flat. The other ones come in a can.
Right. Yeah. One time I bought 288 orange balls from one company, and then the felt was coming apart from the rubber. So I called them and I said, hey, I think I got a bad batch. Do you want to send me a better batch that are fine? I mean, I'll accept if you want to trade them out. They didn't do it. They accepted the ball back, gave me a full refund. I think they knew that they had completely failed to make a good orange ball. So, let the buyer beware out there. Really test stuff and make sure that it's going to work for you before. And I would say, don't be loyal to any particular brand on this. You know, go get the best possible red ball you can get. Get the best possible orange, green. You know, I use actually four different brands. You know, I use a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and I change balls based on what the temperature is.
Yeah, that's a great point.
So, well, thank you. All right. So now, if you had to say one thing, there was something that tennis processing might change their minds on being more supportive of the mandate. That's it. Or have you already said it?
Bill, you dropped out a little bit there. I think your question was, what would be one suggestion to pros? Was that what it was?
Well, no. Okay. Look, you know, in the battle of hearts and minds, all right, you wanna influence the tennis pros and the parents and kids who are listening to the show, and you wanna make your final pitch to to supporting the mandate and using transition balls, what additional do you have to say, or is there something you want to reinforce to win that battle?
Well, I think, and, I'm not trying to win people over. I think that's probably the key element here. But if I give you two examples, I think that may, hopefully potentially influence some people to give it a go and have a try and see how it works for them. By no means am I telling them they have to do this. But one example, and I did this tournament at the previous club I was at, and we had eight kids on each team. They were all playing red ball. We had eight teams. I had 64 kids. I had multiple clubs involved that were around the area. I was running around like a crazy man trying to get everything organized. And what I did I stopped and watched these red ball guys. They played tiebreakers. So they were playing a tiebreaker and then they'd rotate around. So anyway, I was watching one match, two boys that were playing. They were 5 and 6 years old. And one of the coaches said, "You got to check this out. They're having a battle." So I'm running around trying to organize everything. So I stop and watch the last point of their tiebreaker. They're 6 all, these two boys. They start playing. I count the rally. I get up to 32. Someone calls my name. They need something. I turn around. I miss the last two shots of the rally. They get to a 34-ball rally, a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old. And their strokes, their strokes are pretty good. They've got some technical things they need to address, and they will over time, but they're pretty good. I didn't see the last point. I didn't know who won. So I walk up to the net. The boys shake hands, and they say, good game. They walk over to the scorer, which is one of the coaches, and report the score. I'm listening behind it because, again, I still don't know who won. This young boy says, he's asked who won. He said, "Score was 7-6, and my friend won." But he's reporting the score. His buddy won the match. They walk over there. They walk over there to report the score. They walk off the court with arm in arm, having a successful experience. But in my mind, from a coach's standpoint, a 34-ball rally with decent technique, I mean, that's huge at 5 and 6. And I'll give you one other example, Bill, before I take up all your time. I've had many people tell me, and you know about this as far as teaching, and I know you like the craft, tell me that the 5-year-olds can't use a continental grip and cannot use a one-handed backhand. I take that information on board. I'm like, well, maybe I can see how that would relate. I definitely know the yellow ball is very heavy for a 5-year-old, and it's very difficult to swing a large racket that's too big for a 5-year-old. I have done this. I've had a 5-year-old with a one-handed Eastern backhand grip, topspin, cross court and down the line, going to a continental grip to hit a slice and using his continental grip on his serve as a 5-year-old. And I just think back in my playing days, oh, man, if I was able to do that at 5, wow, that would have been pretty special, I think.
Well, that really resonates with me, Nigel, because when I was 7, my mom took me out with a 14-ounce wood racket. And I'm not
right.
I was skinny as a rail as a kid. I've recently been helping me put on some weight, but I was skinny as a rail, and I could not swing that 14-ounce tennis racket. So it delayed me starting tennis. Now, within a couple of years, then the aluminum rackets came out, and when I was able to get an aluminum racket that, was probably, 12 ounces, then I could play. So it was
right.
4 years. It was 4 years until I could start playing tennis again, a part of the reason why I coach is because I believe that I may have had the ability to become a very good player, a very high-level player, but I just didn't really have the opportunity. So, that motivates me as a coach to give that opportunity to kids. And
I'll give you another example. I was in a workshop where...
Actually, we need to wrap it up here, Nigel. We do, because we're getting towards the end here. But, I think those two examples will resonate with a lot of people. And I do believe that more people need to support and get involved in the use of transition balls. But I also do believe that we need to keep those pathways open to keep the higher challenge levels open. Always challenge those kids. So if you could, if you could just summarize all that we've talked about here, how do you wrap up this conversation?
You dropped that again there, Bill. I think your question was to summarize what we've...
How would you summarize our conversation here? What do you think is the major point of what we talked about today?
I think there's a couple of points, and I appreciate your time and your openness to discuss the different areas of the red, orange, green and the development of American tennis. If I could just reiterate two points, and one is, in NorCal we have a structure now with the junior development pathway that is a participation system that will allow kids who are the high performers to get through a lot faster than the masses, which gives them what we call level-based play. And that's where we really want to ensure the kids are playing the right level appropriate for them. But they're the ones that are going to have to prove that. As coaches and as administrators, we don't want to tell them this is where you have to play. We want to give them a starting guide, maybe, but we don't necessarily need to tell them that they have to play there for 3 years or whatever. So we've put that fast-track system in, if you like.
That's very good.
And the last point I want to make is if coaches aren't necessarily open to it, or not open to it, but haven't seen a lot of it, come on board to one of the USDA workshops. Check it out. Just come with an open mind. And, if you can use some of those things in your everyday practice, great. If not, then that's the way it is.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's nice to catch up with you and to have this discussion. I appreciate your thoughtful answers to some pretty tough questions. I would say that you definitely are representing the USTA well in that regard. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
Bill, thanks for your time, and thanks for being open to having me on. I appreciate it, and looking forward to having a chat with you another time.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Bill.
All right. Thank you. Okay, everybody. So, that was great for Nigel to come on, and, I really like the fact that now there's more discussion, there's more dialogue. This is something that's sorely needed. I think those people that are out there that are so vehemently against transition ball use, need to kind of start to see the light a little bit. I'm glad to hear that the USTA is, especially in NorCal, is adopting a more flexible approach. That would be wonderful if that also, spread across the country. Here in NorCal, the NorCal section of the USTA has been doing some great things, and you may have heard about some of our higher-level players. We have the kid that just won nationals and got to the U.S. Open, and then another kid qualified for Cincinnati Masters. So, which isn't, I don't know. It is what it is, and I hope that everybody who's listening to this, I hope you've got some feedback for me. Keep those emails coming, infinitetennis8@gmail.com, infinitetennis8@gmail.com. And I'm available for tennis lessons in the 510 and the 925, and if you live there, you know what I'm talking about. So, as is my custom, I will leave you with this.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.